Reset your system clock to 1993, recharge that shield generator, and join us on today's multimedia hyperguide tour of MS-DOS and Windows 3.1. Welcome back. I'm your host, Super VGA, and in today's episode, we're shelling into a DOS prompt to play Delphine Software's cinematic platformer, Flashback. Well, it's wonderful being back in my little recording cubicle, surrounded by a ton of computing hardware once again. It's unfortunately getting a little jam-packed for my taste, and that's kind of because about a week ago, I stumbled upon a pair of Roland MA-12C micro monitors. If the name doesn't quite ring a bell, it doesn't exactly roll off the tongue. These are the white slash kind of beige speakers with Roland branded across the speaker grills. I'm sure some of you are familiar with the design from LGR or Lazy Game Reviews. These became a little bit ubiquitous on forums after he did a review and posted about them. They're quite beautiful. So when I saw them selling locally, I could not resist buying them. They have this professional music studio kind of vibe, and it pairs really, really well, color-wise at least, with my IBM EduQuest 35. They sound fantastic. I'm not a fan of having a subwoofer kind of tangled around my feet when I'm playing games. I'm not sure why that's always kind of bothered me. I loved having a sub when I was younger, but these days it just feels like it's something else in the way. So having these speakers with internal amps of, I think there are 10 watt amp per speaker. That doesn't seem like much, but back in the day, that was fairly incredible, especially for something specifically used to be as a computer speaker. While that may be of much interest to me, the interesting part for this podcast was exactly how I got them. The seller lived about half an hour away from me and mentioned that the speakers, when I went to visit him, that the speakers were practically brand new and they sat unused in his computer store for almost 30 years. So I was interested, computer store? What was the name? And he said, oh, you know, the Programmers Guild. And he was kind of not quite proud, not quite embarrassed. The name definitely rang a bell to me, and it took a few seconds to remember that I knew it from a disc label that I had on a 5 1/4 inch floppy that I kind of found in a box full of shareware from the 90s. And I said, oh yeah, I remember that place. It was down on this and this street, you know, close to downtown, etc. And he said, oh yeah, yeah, that was us. So we talked a few minutes about his computer store, and he lamented that he left the company in the mid-90s to found an ISP. And I said, oh, wow, there weren't a lot of ISPs in our city in those days. What was the name? And he said, oh, you wouldn't know it. It was called Internet Connect. Now, I did not even need a microsecond to remember that name because it was the first ISP in my city to offer unlimited dial-up at an unbelievable price of $19.95 a month in 1997. Now, $20 a month for dial-up internet access may not sound super incredible to us now, but remember that, let's say, 2 years earlier in 1995, you couldn't even get dial-up internet unless you attended a local university or college. It was really difficult to get on the net without some sort of place to hook you up. And if you did attend the university, there were extremely strict limits on dial-up. I think at the time it limited you to 1 hour of access per dial. I think the solution there was because students were kind of connecting and then leaving it on for 5 or 6 hours in a row. So the university would randomly disconnect you after 1 hour of connection use, and then you'd have to redial, and you could, you know, you could spend hours trying to redial to get back into the modem pool. So when in 1997, when I was going to my first year of university, having access to unlimited dial-up was awesome. Because like I said, that 1 hour connection rule, which was still enforced, I think it was pushed up to 2 hours, by 1997. That wouldn't get you far, especially if you were a, let's say data hoarder like I was in 1997. So anyway, I was really excited when he told me this, and I said, oh yeah, of course I know your company. And he laughed, and he was surprised that I recognized the name at all. And then I kind of sheepishly mentioned that I was probably among one of the Internet Connect's worst users / abusers. I would basically dial up at, you know, 7 a.m. whenever I got out of bed that day, sometimes 1 p.m. And then the line would be up and running 24/7 for months at a time. I'm not exaggerating. I really do mean, unless there was a power outage or a lightning storm and that knocked out the telephone lines in the neighborhood, I was probably having a continuous connection for 2 to 3 months at a time. It got so bad that one day my mom showed up knocking at the door, and I'm like, oh, mom, what are you doing here? And she lived in a different city at that point. I was attending university. And she said, I was worried about you. And I said, well, why? She said, I've been trying to get a hold of you for over a month. Your phone has been busy every time I've called. And I kind of laughed, and I was like, oh, well, you know, no one ever calls me, so why wouldn't I just leave my internet on all the time? So always on internet was great for me and not so great for my mom, who was constantly worried about me in my first year of attending university, and also probably not so great for this guy who was running a $20 a month ISP. So he said to me, you know what, you probably weren't our worst user, because if you were, we would have banned you outright. We used to run a little lottery every month, kicking our worst users off permanently and then banning them. Whoops. So I didn't get kicked or banned, but I'm glad I was. Maybe if I was in their top 10 users every month, I wasn't in their top like 3. So maybe I didn't enter that little lottery of banning. So back in those days, the reason why I was on 24/7 wasn't just because I was a, you know, rampant internet pirate, which I was, but it was also because I was playing this game called Ultima Online, and I was playing it with my trusty US Robotics 56K Sportster modem that I had for a year or two up to that point. Before that, I think I had a 33.6. And then before the 33.6, I had a 28.8, and then before the 28.8, I had a 14.4, and before the 14.4, I had a 2400 baud modem. So you can see, and this was all in the span of maybe 3 years. I'm not joking. I went from 2400 baud in 1994 to 56K in 1997-98. I mean, that was like, I don't know how, that's a 20 times jump in speed, I think, just off the top of my head. That's not great math. So until cable modems came out, and I think cable modems came out maybe 2 or 3 years later in my city, around 1999, maybe around 2000. It would be around 2000, actually. Yeah, 2000, 2001. So it's so wonderful when you run into these folks that were around during the good old bad old days of internet dial-up, and being able to chat with them and nerd out and geek out about those old stories. So, and I think it made him quite happy to know that he had a pretty satisfied customer, and I even still remembered his company, you know, 20 years later. The vast majority of time when I go to pick up this kind of stuff, it's just somebody who's found something that was rotting in their, you know, parents' garage, and they decided they can make a few bucks off of it, which is fine. You know, you end up getting stuff really cheap that way too. But you know, 1 in 10 times, 1 in 20 times, I'll run into somebody who's really, really passionate about the hobby, and they're just trying to clear out some space for whatever their new hobby is, or they've decided to get out of the hobby altogether, and I just love having those conversations. And I love also getting the story behind, you know, this stuff, and learning its provenance. I think that's the right word, provenance, that they would use that in collecting. I love those moments, and I hope to have another one. The speakers cost me quite a bit of money. I think they cost me about $100 altogether, something like that, maybe even $120. Anyway, a lot less than I would pay on eBay, but more than I would ever expect to spend on computer speakers. In fact, I think that was even more than on my Creative T40, Creative GigaWorks T40 modern speakers, but still, nothing beats that white, off-white beige look with the Roland branding. It is just beautiful. I'm not going to go into a tremendous amount of detail today on the inventory check, just because I honestly wonder if anybody's actually interested in this other than me. It sounds kind of boring to just go through all the stuff I found. I don't know. Does it matter to anybody else? Let me know. If you want me to get rid of this segment, I would love to know. So write to me, VGA@VGA256.com. Going through my stuff here, I got a copy of Deluxe Paint Animation. This is really interesting. D-Paint, I'm sure most of you know, was the kind of ubiquitous paint program used back in the late 80s, early 90s. For most game development, honestly, that was happening on the PC and Amiga, and Atari ST and a bunch of other products. But I think most people, you know, did their development work on an Amiga or a PC. Anyway, I found out very recently that the makers of D-Paint went out and actually made an animation package that had the same goals. That was not just to be, you know, an amateur fun paint package, but also one that professionals could use to integrate animation into their games. So this came in very recently. I'm flipping it open here. It's got one thing about D-Paint is Electronic Arts put quite a bit of money into producing a very huge, thick manual. I think it's 300 pages. Gigantic manual, spiral bound with those little metal wires things. I haven't been through this manual yet. This would be weeks and weeks of reading. But honestly, D-Paint looks like a beautiful animation package. I can't wait to use this. It looks like a combination. Sorry, I said D-Paint. I meant D-Paint Animation. D-Paint, it looks like it integrates the best parts of Deluxe Paint as well as adding animation options to it. So anyway, I can't wait to talk about this at some point. I'll probably talk about Deluxe Paint in its own episode because it's such a ubiquitous package. And I need to train myself in how to even use it. It sure will probably feel pretty familiar to me because my favorite 2D sprite-based animation package I use now, called Aceprite, is actually designed to be almost identical to the functionality of D-Paint. So anybody familiar with Aceprite, or if you're not familiar with it, I highly, 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 highly recommend it if you are planning on doing any amount of 2D animation or just 2D pixel paint in Windows, Mac, or Linux. Hardware-wise, I got a very strange little find last week. Something called a Dynalogic Hyperion Luggable Computer. If you're not familiar with this, I sure wasn't. This was a Canadian built in Ontario, Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. I didn't even know Canada built computers. I knew that we had, like, you know, generic cases that we resold because there were companies like, Shonix? Scenix? I think it was called Scenix. That was based out of Vancouver, BC, or Richmond, BC, somewhere on the West Coast. But Scenix basically just took, you know, a standard case and stuck a bunch of parts in it and put a brand on it. I mean, every company did that back in the 90s and 2000s. This is actually a uniquely designed and built computer. It's an 8088 with a built-in 7-inch monochrome amber monitor. And this is the fascinating part. This is why I picked it up, even though it's in terrible condition. It is the world's first IBM clone, as it came out a few months before the Compaq Portable. If you're not familiar with what a luggable is, or if you just want a refresher course, then the luggable is a good name for it, because it is not portable, even though they call it the Compaq Portable. It is basically a long horizontal computer with a tiny 7-inch monitor on the left side, and then disk drives on the right side. And then there's also usually a keyboard that actually snaps onto the front face for, or in the case of the Dynalogic Hyperion, slides underneath. And it's meant you could stick it inside of a small suitcase and lug it around. And, you know, they also have a grip handle on it, so you could probably lug it around that way, too. But when I say lug, I mean lug. They weigh like 20, 30 pounds. And you're not going to want to take this with you on your walk to the Starbucks to compute for a few hours. This was meant to stick it in a suitcase and take it on the plane with you, or maybe stick it in the back seat of your car if you're heading out of town somewhere. Unfortunately, when we say first IBM clone, it's not quite a clone. It's actually not quite IBM compatible, because it does not have the matching system ROM calls that the Compaq Portable was actually famous for reverse engineering from the IBM PC. Now, the fascinating part of this story for me is that the specific machine I picked up last week, has a really cool provenance. The guy selling it turned out to be a huge BBS nerd. It was one of those funny one-off things. He just offhandedly mentioned that, he said, if you happen to know what an acoustic coupler is, you can get an acoustic coupler for your machine too. And I'm like, I totally know what an acoustic coupler is. Are you into BBSing? And he's like, of course. And then, you know, you have this nerdy conversation for 20 minutes talking about the good old BBS days. He told me that he found this Hyperion computer in his aunt's, elderly aunt's barn, and had been sitting there for the better part of 25 or 30 years. And this is why I mentioned earlier, it's in terrible condition. The machine is literally rusting to death from the inside out. It sat in some sort of, in its luggable case. Unfortunately, the case zipper wasn't fully sealed, and it humidity and rain and every smelly, dirty thing you could possibly imagine got into this case. So the computer itself is literally rusting out. All of the screws are rusty, but it does turn on, so it's functional. So when I can finally, you know, remove all of this rust, you know, all these rusty screws, and actually open it up, I might be able to determine whether or not this is rescuable. The floppy drives, I don't think, are in great shape. I don't know if they're going to work. But anyway, it was cool finding out that his aunt was a travel agent for a major airline back in the early 1980s, and the airline wanted her to go from city to city to sell travel packages to people. And the best way to do that was actually to give her some software and a luggable computer, so she could sit down, you know, at a client's kitchen table and show them all of the options. So he gave me a box of diskettes with, I think it's IBM MS-DOS, or I guess this would be called IBM DOS 2.1, and a bunch of other diskettes in there. I'm hoping some of them might be actually her travel agency software. That would be amazing. The reason I personally wanted this, aside from its really cool, weird provenance and Canadian builtness, was because I love that 7-inch amber monochrome monitor. It's hard to explain to anybody, but monochrome amber monitors look extremely beautiful in person, especially when they get shrunk down to 7 inches. 7 inches is not big. You can probably pent together your middle fingers and your thumbs into a square, and that's about the exact size of that screen. I'm doing it right now in front of the mic. It looks beautiful. So in the end, if this machine is not rescuable, I'm probably going to extract that 7-inch monochrome monitor to do something really, really cool with it. Just so you know, I'm not into junking great machines, but there's a complete possibility this thing is not rescuable, given the amount of rust. If you want a picture of it, I'm sure I can email it to you. Other pickups, I got a weird one the other day. Civilization 2 Fantastic Worlds, the Scenarios and Construction Kit package. That came in. It's a really interesting set of, you know, additional scenarios and tile graphics for Civ 2 that adds some really funny custom environments. There's the Samurai, I'm reading off the back of the box here. Samurai, what if East never met West? Midgard, this is the Midgard package. A world of dragons, goblins, and quests for treasure, so that'll probably be, you know, be their Lord of the Rings knockoff. This totally intrigued me. Dinosaurs, play a dino tribe in this what if the dinosaurs hadn't died out scenario. I love that. I mean, that screams Sid Meier, that Sid's like, oh yeah, do that. Jules Verne, enter a world of Jules Verne creations. That sounds kind of fascinating. I kind of wonder what, you know, I'm guessing this is going to be like the hot air balloon / steampunk kind of stuff. I don't really know. This is unbelievable. XCOM, based on the hit series, play as XCOM fighting against the alien menace. That's so cool. I would have never thought of trying this. And I'm looking on the back. There's actually really great sprite work for the dinosaur one, so I can't wait to try that. And finally, I know this one was a big deal over at Microsoft that never quite happened. Mars, colonize the red planet. I mentioned last episode that I had read the Sid Meier's memoir book. He actually mentions in there that they always tried or always wanted to make a dinosaur game and a Mars-based civilization game, and it never quite worked out. So this is kind of the closest that they got to producing that at Microprose. And in another weird twist of it being a small world, I picked up 4 Epic Pinball games. Thanks to, and I'm going to munge your name, Dan, I apologize, because I'm not sure if it's a soft C or a hard C. I'm going to say it's a hard C, Dan Policar. He is the musician-composer doing the soundtrack for Julia Minamata's The Crimson Diamond AGS game. That's the one that's done in 16-color EGA. And it's an adventure game. Dan, and I just ran into him on Facebook Marketplace. Dan sent me 4 tables, and these are the 4 Epic Pinball tables in their original boxes, and 3 of them are even shrink-wrapped, unbelievably. I got Enigma, Deep Sea, Crash and Burn, and Cyborg Girl. I can't believe that after all these years, it took me this long to realize that Cyborg Girl is actually just a riff on Cyborg. I don't know why, I just didn't see it. If you're not familiar with these tables, it's probably because you, like me, only played the shareware version of Epic Pinball, and that probably came with Android for you, as it did for me. I'd love to do an episode on Epic Pinball because its history involves an incredibly talented yet not really known developer named James Schmaltz. There's a completely fascinating history behind James Schmaltz and his game being picked up by Epic Mega Games through Tim Sweeney, a Finnish demo scene group called Future Crew. There's so much stuff happening there. It's an incredible story. I'd love to do an episode on it someday. And thankfully, a lot of that history has already been written, so I don't have to do tremendous amounts of research as I did for this episode. So there's our segue onto our main topic, the cinematic platformer Flashback, and this is for North Americans, The Quest for Identity by Delphine Software International. I will never forget the day that I saw Flashback for the first time in person. It was Christmas 1993, and in the months prior, I had read about how incredible this game was in video game magazines like GamePro. It was in a neighborhood mall that I had been to many, many times because it had a CompuCenter in it. I'm sure I've mentioned CompuCenter on previous episodes. CompuCenter was a 1990s Canadian chain computer store that you could find in more than a few malls, and it only sold computer hardware and software, unlike the bigger chains in the States like Egghead or Software, etc., who had a combination of computer software, video games, that kind of stuff. The prices at these CompuCenter, I'm guessing it's probably more like a CompUSA now that I think about it. The prices at CompuCenter were always a bit higher than the local mom and pop stores, but I really liked going there because they always had the hottest hardware and games on display at the front of the store. The stands kind of, what they had were basically standees, or I'm not sure what to call them, independent stands like racks with a monitor, the computer and a keyboard on it, and then they would wheel that out just like maybe two or three steps outside of the store into the mall hallway to kind of attract in people walking around on the mall floor, just like you'd have like a attract mode on an arcade game. Well, that year, this is Christmas of 93, the hottest thing going around, the new thing, was multimedia. A single-speed CD-ROM and speakers and sound card together cost about, I want to say, $800 to $1,200, and only the highest-end computers were actually getting them pre-packaged with a computer. So normally you'd actually buy the computer and then buy a separate package to at extreme cost, like $1,200, to get the CD-ROM and sound card. The computer on display that day at CompuCenter was a Compaq Presario CDT-528. The Presarios in those days were called all-in-one units that had a 14-inch CRT with the desktop part of the machine all molded together with the screen. It even had a pair of computer speakers mounted on the inside of the box, giving it this slick, almost Macintosh-like look. I'm sure it was trying to emulate the Mac LCs at the time, or were they Mac Quadras? I can't remember. I had never seen anything like it prior to this moment. This was my first time seeing a Presario. Our Amstrad computer was this anemic 8 megahertz XT, which did have VGA graphics at the time, which was very unusual for an XT, but it didn't have a sound card and it definitely didn't have computer speakers. Now, that would change in a few weeks because on Christmas Eve, my parents would give me an Adlib synthesizer card, and I would actually have to hook up my tiny Game Boy earbuds to use the synthesizer card because I couldn't afford computer speakers. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Not only did this Presario CDT have a CD-ROM and sound card blasting digitized sounds into the mall, but it was even equipped with a video capture card that let you watch TV on screen while other stuff was happening on the computer. So you could actually have TV picture in picture in the corner of the screen while you were in Windows. It was unbelievable. It was like the entire future had arrived in this one machine. So I stood there. At the time, I would be about 14 years old. I stood there in front of the machine, completely transfixed in the mall hallway. For anybody keeping count, I actually mentioned this machine in an earlier episode. This was the very same computer that I once tried to sneak my CD-ROM Today discs onto before I got, you know, almost caught and scurried away because they thought I was maybe going to break into the computer and steal their disc or something. Back in those days, I'm sure that was a thing to hit the eject button and steal the CD inside. But anyway, an employee walked over while I was watching this demo mode on for the Compaq Presario run. He futzed around with the machine for a couple of minutes and then exited whatever rolling demo was running. I think it was a Compaq Presario specific demo. I can't remember the demo itself. He was installing something from a couple of diskettes. So while he did that, I wandered off to the software section while he did his thing. 5 minutes later, I came back and I was spellbound. Aside from Out of This World, or Another World if you're in Europe, which I had obsessively played for the past year, I had never seen a rotoscoped cinematic introduction like the one that was playing on screen in front of me. It was so smooth. Eventually, the game launched into a gameplay demo, and I watched the protagonist, roll, dive, and leap his way across what looked like an alien jungle planet. The colors were rich. The animation was, again, so smooth that I was convinced that this had to be multimedia. This was a CD-ROM of some kind. It was months before I realized that this guy, you know, the employees who was installing stuff off of diskettes was installing this game from those two discs. I couldn't believe it. Flashback alone is solely responsible for me getting into an obsession with multimedia and CD-ROMs in 1993 because I was so convinced that this game had to have shipped on a CD-ROM that I needed a CD-ROM for our home computer. How we ended up with a multimedia PC is a topic for a completely other podcast, but sadly, the irony is that even when we did get a multimedia machine in 94, I didn't actually play Flashback until 1997. This was 4 years after I saw it in the mall. In 97, I was on a trip to the United States with my mother to visit my father. My father was working at the time constructing a university there. My mother had kind of begrudgingly allowed me to take her prized Toshiba 4800 CT laptop. That's a 486 DX475, I want to say, along for the ride. She was always convinced that someone was going to steal this thing somehow. You know, if you take it on the bus, someone's going to steal it. If you take it to school, someone's going to steal it. If you take it in your car, someone's going to steal it. I guess realistically, those are probably all true now that I think about it, now that I'm an adult. But when I was 14 years old or 15 and 16 years old, no way, I didn't believe that. So on this 20-hour drive south, I sat in the passenger seat and played Flashback obsessively. You know, I learned the keyboard controls. This was a pirated copy, just FYI. I learned the keyboard controls one mistake at a time until I got to the final planet. And unbelievably, I never finished the game. And until this week, in preparation for this podcast, I had never actually seen the ending. So in this episode, we're going to look at the prehistory and development of Flashback, as well as its, you know, developing company, Delphine Software, as well as what we can expect in the near future for what I consider to be one of the greatest cinematic platformers of all time. As a quick overview of what this game is, Flashback is known as a cinematic puzzle platformer. That is, you move across the screen, leaping across platforms as you'd see in a game like Super Mario, except that the on-screen action is punctuated by cutscenes that advance the storyline. Now, the puzzle part of Puzzle Platformer comes in the form of switches and levers, doors and locks, as well as coming up with solutions for confronting enemies that have been placed in strategic positions. You know, you see this in the kind of game where an enemy is pacing back and forth in one area, and if you jump straight down into that area, boom, you're going to get shot and killed. But if you figure out that, oh, if I leap off of this one platform onto the next one, I can get in behind the, you know, the enemy and shoot him in the back, that kind of thing. Furthermore, cinematic here is understood to mean more realistic than fantasy games like the Mario Brothers. We'll talk about that a little later in the style section, because that's actually a very important part of what makes this a cinematic platformer. Now let's talk grand story arc. Flashback takes place in an alternate history where humankind establishes interplanetary colonies and government control runs rampant over the population, imprisoning political dissidents, and with Earth's economy and its ecosystems collapsing. And with all this going on, children are actually developing genomic defects. Then people are calling these children mutants. In Flashback's intro cinematic, we watch an unnamed man in a leather jacket flee from assailants firing laser rifles at him. He eventually escapes on hoverbike, only to be shot down deep in the jungle by a pursuing aircraft. Presumed dead, the hero is left to fend for himself with nothing but a pistol and rechargeable shield in a jungle encased in a large dome that turns out to be the interplanetary colony on the moon Titan. you soon find a holocube that shows a recorded message that you've left for yourself. You find out that your name is Conrad, and that if you're going to survive and unravel the mystery of who you really are, you need to track down your friend Ian in New Washington. After some time, and this is, you know, after you've gotten the gameplay going, the hero manages to escape the dangerous jungle he crash-landed in and makes his way to New Washington. We eventually learn that the hero's name is Conrad B. Hart, ex-graduate student in the physical sciences, I think in physics, and that his doctoral thesis involved the creation of a pair of glasses that can detect aliens posing as human beings. Fearing capture, he sends a copy of his memories to his friend Ian, so he literally does a brain dump and sends it to his friend Ian. As expected, the aliens abduct Conrad, erase his memory, hoping to keep their infiltration of human society a secret. Well, Conrad manages to escape, and this is the intro cinematic, and this leaves us where the rest of the gameplay continues from. The rest of the story involves Conrad through a series of dangerous missions, making his way from New Washington, then to Earth, so New Washington is not on Earth, then to Earth, where he discovers the secret of the alien invasion. His last stop is on the alien planet, where he puts an end to the alien menace once and for all. So let's talk system requirements. There are many, many ports of this game, so I'm going to talk about three major versions of this game in this podcast. Why three? Why not just IBM PC? Well, that's because the IBM PC was actually a port of the original, and arguably, it's hard to know what the original was. Some people, including the developers, say the original system was designed for the Sega Mega Drive or Genesis. Other people say, well, it was developed on an Amiga, even though it was for the Mega Drive, so it's technically was first an Amiga game, which I actually agree with. Other people say, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to talk about all three versions in this podcast. The Amiga version, which is relevant to this episode, required at least an Amiga 1000 or 500 with 1 meg of RAM. In comparison, the MS-DOS version required a 286 16 megahertz with 1 meg of RAM and a VGA card. In 1993, however, these were fairly easy requirements to hit, as the Intel 486 was already out by this time. If you put the Amiga and the PC versions head-to-head, it's actually clear that the PC version's requirements are much higher, 16 megahertz instead of the 7 megahertz 68,000. Why the difference? Well, that's because the Amiga had supporting chipsets to handle things like video, audio, and music. And this allows you to offload some of the work that the CPU needs to do, whereas the Intel version, the CPU is doing everything because you have no ability to rely on third-party chips. Third-party? That's not the right word. Secondary chips to handle that workload. Now, I noticed that the game requires 1 meg of memory on the PC. I still can't determine if this was just an estimate that they actually only really require 640K, or if it's using 640K low memory, that's the lower memory blocks, plus the remaining 384K of high memory for cache and graphics swap. I don't know. I couldn't actually try this out because DOSBox does not allow you to completely disable and pretend that there's less than 1 meg of RAM. I think you just get 1 meg of RAM with DOSBox, but please somebody correct me if that's not true. Did anybody ever try running Flashback on their 640K 286 or 640K XT? Please write me. If you did, I'd love to know if it actually worked. I'd love to try that out on my Tandy 1000 TL2. Unfortunately, that Tandy 1000 TL2 doesn't even have 640K RAM. It only has, I want to say 512K or 500 and some K RAM, because it's actually sharing some of its RAM with the video card. So the video card's stealing, like, I think 64K or 128K right off the top. So it's not even worth trying on that machine. Regardless, for the PC version, in terms of conventional or low memory, it requires a minimum of 542K that will produce a bare playable game without sound and music. If you've got 560K free, you'll get sound and music in-game, but cinematics will probably not have music. You'll need a kingly 583K to get the full meal deal. Thankfully, however, this game does not support a mouse as an input method on the PC version, so you don't have to worry about unloading your mouse driver to play it. Loading your mouse driver to play it. The game specifically supports the Gravis gamepad and its four-button configuration. I think that's fantastic. Very few games had Gravis support right out of the box. That's awesome. Now, for Intel versions, there is a KIXX, that's Kix European CD-ROM edition that was released, I think in 95, maybe. It upped the ante. It required a 386 with a CD-ROM drive and, wow, 4 megs of RAM. I suspect that this game used pre-rendered cutscenes streaming off the disk instead of the polygons we're used to. I didn't actually check this version out on YouTube, so please correct me if I'm wrong. The pre-rendered graphics that I did see were not altogether fantastic. I personally thought the... the 2D hand rotoscoped cutscenes were far more beautiful. But anyway, it supports the venerable Adlib synthesizer card, that's OPL2, the Sound Blaster, Sound Blaster Pro, OPL3, and the King of Kings, the Roland MT32. On the Amiga side, the Amiga version takes advantage of the Amiga's custom Paula sound chip using its 4 PCM sample channels, 2 for left, 2 for right, to produce an incredible, and I mean incredible, tracker soundtrack featuring stereo pans and reversals. There is no comparison, even between the MT32 version and the Amiga version. The Amiga version just wins. I'll talk about why we have this difference in the development history section and the tech specs section, but I honestly recommend checking out the Amiga version. It's going to knock your socks off. So let's talk style and gameplay. Like most other platformers of its time, Flashback is broken up into a series of levels, and each level is comprised of a dozen or more screens. The level has been completed when you escape its confines or discover a means for travel to another area or level. That being said, unlike other platforming games of its time, such as Super Mario Bros., Flashback does not always follow a left-to-right path. Sometimes you find yourself exploring right-to-left, or top-to-bottom, or bottom-to-top. There's a very strong sense of verticality in almost every environment, whether through the use of riding elevators or leaping from one platform ledge to another. The same can't be said for something like, Super Mario 2, where in some levels the screen's actually scrolling left to right, and if you get caught at the left side of the screen, you die. It's not like that at all. Flashback's focus is much more on an open world experience as far as a platformer understands what open world means. Gameplay shares more with a game like Prince of Persia than any other game. Prince of Persia also does away with the left-to-right progression in favor of all kinds of up-and-down, right-and-left exploration. Another World, or Out of This World, is an obvious candidate for comparison on the surface, but there is, I think, an inherent difference between Another World and Flashback. Another World relies upon bespoke gameplay mechanics in several places. For instance, there's a scene where you laser shot a boulder to collapse it into a stairway, or you break open a reservoir of water to flood an entire level. Flashback, on the other hand, doesn't have these kinds of bespoke mechanics. In Flashback, you're always using the same actions in different places. You're going to fire your gun, you're going to roll, jump, grab a ledge. It's all about the level layout, which tends to dictate the proper actions for Conrad. Another World, on the other hand, is anything but repetitive in the way it handles each bespoke puzzle. As I mentioned earlier, this is a cinematic platformer. Cinematic is understood to mean photorealistic, insofar as realism is an integral part of the experience. But realistic in what ways? Well, more realistic physics. For instance, in this game, if you fall too far, you die instead of just landing on your feet. That's not true in Super Mario Brothers. It's got more realistic art. It's got, for instance, rotoscope photography instead of fantasy pixel art. Think about Super Mario Brothers. You are literally in the Mushroom Kingdom with you know, strange psychedelic mushrooms everywhere. Whereas in this game, it's meant to really look like photographs that have been reduced down to pixel sizes. And on that note, the world itself is more photorealistic too. The game has a dark, futuristic New Washington instead of the Mushroom Kingdom. Narrative cutscenes take their cue from cinema, with slow pans, extreme close-ups, as opposed to the more theatrical-style staging you see in Super Mario Brothers, where characters are standing a few feet apart at a side view, talking to each other or the audience without any complex sense of perspective via a camera. A cinematic camera can let the audience experience multiple perspectives every few seconds. Now, in this game, animation runs at 24 frames per second in the PC version. The goal was to run actually at a much higher FPS, but as we'll talk about later in the tech section, the Genesis had some drawbacks with its cartridge-based storage that prevented them from using animation at higher frame rates. Again, the animation here is to provide the most realistic sense of movement. Now, in terms of UI design, the screen is surprisingly free of a HUD, aside from a single icon in the top right to show the currently active inventory item. Unlike most other platformers, there is a real-time inventory system. Keep in mind, Mario 3 does have an inventory system, but it's only accessible from the overworld, not in gameplay. Hitting Tab on the PC version brings up the inventory panel, which shows the number of credits you have, that's cash, and lets you navigate between your inventory items. The shield item shows how many charges your rechargeable shield has. Selecting an inventory item allows Conrad to ready it for gameplay. Hitting Enter while you're holding an inventory item, like the Holo Cube, just uses it. You'll find that this is extremely important for items like keys or key cards, which need to be used in front of the lock you are trying to unlock. This really tripped me up when I was a kid because I didn't understand how keys worked in the game. There are multiple ways of using something. On that note, the keyboard controls are rather, as we might say, unique and different from other platformers. There is no jump button exactly. You press up to jump, and jumping is context sensitive. So if Conrad is at a standstill, he will leap straight up if you hit the up key, like kind of the way you'd do a jumping jack. If he's in the middle of a run, however, pressing up will make him take a flying leap, like you'd see in a track and field long jump. Conrad's offensive weapon is his pistol. You can fire it as an automatic weapon. There's no need to reload it or recharge it, and it will happily fire ad infinitum. There's also a melee swing pistol attack for enemies within one tile of Conrad or standing kind of right against Conrad. Conrad's movement, while smoothly animated, is tile-based under the hood. That means that when Conrad moves from one space to the next, he moves one tile at a time. To give you a sense for the possibility space of movement on the screen is 16 tiles wide by 12 tiles tall. So any one screen, that's the playfield in which Conrad can move around in. Conrad can only fire his gun from a standstill and can only edge forward, gun unfireable while he's walking, with the gun drawn. To run, you'll have to holster the gun. You can't jump while holding the gun, but you can fall. And if you do fall while the gun is unholstered, this will land him in a crouch position, gun drawn. And he can just go pop, 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 you know, fire off some shots when the gun is drawn. Very, very cool. Crouching down with the down arrow key and pressing a directional key will make Conrad tuck and roll forward. So he'll actually do a somersault. And if you have the gun drawn, when he unfolds from his somersault, it'll be drawn again, which is, it just looks really, really cool. And it's super useful for gameplay because you can roll forward from one screen into the next with the gun drawn. And when he pops into the next screen, you can pop off some shots really quick. You will need to learn how to do that to win this game. Later in the game, you'll find yourself doing all kinds of missions for pay, some requiring you to talk to NPCs. To talk, hold down the shift key in front of an NPC when the talk icon appears in the top left corner of the screen. This is what is called an action icon in the manual. Sometimes in the game, you're going to see what is called an activate icon in the top left. This looks like a lever with an arrow beside it, and this means you can activate a switch like an elevator switch. And in order to do this, you have to hold down shift to activate it. That's right, you can't just tap shift to use, you have to hold it down. The manual goes into some amount of detail about when tapping a key versus pressing and holding a key are appropriate. The game has two kinds of saves. There is a checkpoint-based save system that lets you restart from the last save point from when you die. There are not very many checkpoints in each level, I'm going to warn you ahead of time, and some even have none. This is a pain point in the game. Now here's the sticky spot. If you exit the game, you have to use a password-based save that restarts you at the very start of that level. Trust me, you can lose a lot of progress if you accidentally quit or exit without just forgetting losing your checkpoint. If you forget to write down that password, you are hooped. You're going to start on the level before that, which is even worse. So make sure, two things, make sure you write down your passwords, that matters, but also make sure you exit the game at the start of a new level so you don't lose like an hour of progress next time you start. Gameplay wise, again, the shield that you use is automatic. You don't need to activate it or be ready to use it. When Conrad gets hit, and so this is unlike a game like Another World, which you actually have to build a shield with your gun. When Conrad gets hit by an enemy, he briefly flashes invisible to indicate that the shield has been activated. For those few seconds, he's also invincible. So this is very, Sega Mega Drive-ish or Nintendo-ish. This makes for a good technique for taking down enemies that you find difficult to deal with. You just literally just take a hit so you become invincible and then you pop off a few shots to take them out. Later in the game, Conrad gets a force field. This allows Conrad, when it's active in his inventory, to produce another world-like defensive shield in front of him on top of his rechargeable shield. This defensive shield lasts for about 1 second before it disappears, and you actually have to hit enter to activate the shield. So it's separate. It doesn't activate when you shoot your gun. You actually have to hit it separately. This makes for some fairly complex and dynamic keyboarding during combat, to say the least. The PC manual's last page goes through some critical gameplay movement maneuvers that you might not stumble upon yourself by using the keyboard. These are things like releasing a ledge that you're hanging from, dropping down a level, and then catching the ledge below you. Or, for instance, going up and down a lift by holding shift and then pressing up. These kinds of things really catch new players off guard. I think the Sega Mega Drive / Genesis version is better for this in terms of its gamepad movement. One podcast completely ripped apart the game for its control scheme, saying the game was literally unplayable and they never wanted to see it again. Now, let's talk nice surprises. The story is surprisingly engaging. While the wake up with amnesia character context may feel a little tired to a lot of players, the story puts that context to such good use because it tells you who the protagonist is within the first hour of the game. You're not left to find out who you are until the end of the game. You find out very early on, and it's actually helpful for advancing the story further. I found also that there's a real rhythm to running, leaping across a chasm, and diving into a somersault, pulling your gun out and firing, even more so than a game like Prince of Persia or Another World. It's also really fun in some scenes to pick up a stone and toss it to distract a mutant. Some of the levels have really great layout in terms of the way that they set up the enemies so that you are distracting them. You might be able to sneak past them without killing them. You're probably always going to want to kill them because it just makes things more difficult. It's challenging as a game, but it's not unfair or impossible in my books. I think a lot of people say that this game is very, very difficult. I would agree with that, but it's, again, I don't think unfair. It's just very difficult. I found that I really liked the ultra minimalist UI. Unlike the vast majority of platformers of its time, it really wants you to feel like you're sitting there in the audience, in a movie theater, letting the action unfold in front of you, or maybe more specifically, you're behind the camera. I liked that the game felt like it was a complete story, and the game story pays off in the end. It's actually worth getting to the ending. I also like that there are some really nice RPG elements in the game, like being hired to run missions to make money, and you can use that money to advance the story forward. You actually don't use that money to, interestingly, buy upgrades, so that's a little bit un-RPG-like. Dialogue is there in the game, but it's sparing. There is an overriding belief, I think, in the adventure game community that to be an adventure game, you have to have thousands upon thousands of lines of dialogue and dialogue trees to get through that. Flashback, like Another World before it, upends that genre expectation by delivering most of the story through action and exploration punctuated by cutscenes. I thought that was fantastic. Now there are, of course, some not-so-nice surprises. If this is your first time playing Flashback in MS-DOS with the keyboard, you might be very, very put off by the controls. They are just downright difficult to learn, even if they're extremely powerful. You might feel at times like you are programming your computer to move Conrad across the screen. They are hard to learn. To run, jump, and catch an exposed ledge, you need to hold shift and a directional key. Then while holding shift and letting go of the directional key, Conrad will continue running in that direction. And then in order to grab that ledge, instead of pressing up to force Conrad into a jump, you just keep holding shift and he will auto leap and grab onto any available exposed edge. This is totally counterintuitive because you'd expect to want to press up to force a jump. You don't need to, because up really means make Conrad leap across a chasm, Prince of Persia style. Yeah. Now, that being said, I personally love the auto jump and grab technique. It takes some getting used to, but it is absolutely going to be frustrating for you if you come from other platformer games. Also, the checkpoint system is kind of nice, but the password system is not so nice. I found it infuriating to lose as much as an hour of progress by exiting the game prematurely, especially when you get really, really stuck on a level you just can't finish. It's awful to come back to it a day or two later and find out you've got to start from the very beginning. Unfortunately, this was the norm for a lot of platformers in those days. Since Flashback was actually designed specifically for the Sega Mega Drive when it was built, it's not surprising that the PC got this air quotes feature as well. It's too bad, though, that whoever ported it to PC didn't consider just adding manual saves To the PC version to take advantage of its hard drive. It's a real shame because that would have made this game so much more enjoyable for PC players. Finally, this is more of a caveat and envy than anything else, but the Amiga version has such superior music to the PC and Genesis versions. I wish they had found a way to implement tracker music in the PC version. Why didn't they? That's something we are going to talk about in the development history, because that has something to do with a technical part and a historical part of the company Delphine Software International. So that rounds out today's show. I'm going to keep it to 1 hour just because that means we have one full hour of the history of Delphine Software International, as well as the history of Flashback and its development team at Delphine. I can't wait to get to that part of the show. It's already been written, so all you have to wait for is time for me to record this next episode. I can't wait to, of course, get to this part of the show, but that will have to wait for another week. This is your friend Super VJ signing off on another multimedia hybrid guide tool. Let's talk soon.